Are you feeling overwhelmed by hormonal changes? If you're a woman, you're not alone. With over 1,000 hormone disruptors in our environment, it's no wonder things can feel out of balance. On top of that, natural changes like PMS, menopause, and other life stages can leave you feeling tired, irritable, and trapped in a constant battle with your body. But here's the good news. You don't have to suffer through it. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is here to help. This herbal formula fine-tunes your hormones, balancing estrogen, testosterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol, which can contribute to weight gain, racing thoughts, poor sleep, and more. With over 40,000 five-star reviews and a bottle selling every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. Ready to feel like yourself again? For a limited time, get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com using code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
And the worms crawl in, the worms crawl out. They'll eat your guts and spit them out. And when your bones begin to rot, the worms remain, but you do not. So don't ever laugh as a hearse goes by. For someday you'll be next in line. And when death brings his cold despair, ask yourself, will anyone care?
Macabre may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
How are you feeling about today's, your episode?
I've had a couple days away from it and like stopped thinking about it. And I think it's helped me. We'll have to talk more about the other one that I'm looking into right now, because this actually pales in comparison to what I'm researching right now. But yeah, this one is still super dark. It's really interesting. I mean, as morbid as that sounds, it's still a very interesting piece because of how everything happened. I mean, if literally one thing was never said, this would have never happened. That's literally
how crazy
this is. Yeah.
I'm intrigued.
Well, yeah. You're going to be, I'm going to, at the end too, I highly recommend it. But if you've never read In Cold Blood by Truman Capote, you so should. Even knowing what you're going to know after this episode, it's still worth a read. It's really good. There have been movies and a miniseries TV show that came out about this. Sam Neill actually played Dewey in the one that came out in the late 90s. That was like a 3-hour long episode miniseries on the topic, but it was more so written based on how Truman Capote wrote In Cold Blood. So it wasn't necessarily fully true to the true crime case. But we'll talk about that too. But before I get any further, I'm going to go down a rabbit hole today. So before I forget, what's up, Looky Lou's freaky friends, deadly darlings, macabre hotties, listeners? Hello, and welcome to Macabre, a Dark History Podcast. I'm Blair.
I'm Hallie.
And if you're new here, hi. We're really happy you're here. We're kind of winding down for season 2, but we are not slowing down. We have so much more coming for season 2 before it's over, and we're already in the works of season 3. So get excited, because we're excited. And we're so happy that you came to hang out with us. And thank you so much for choosing Macabre as your entertainment of the hour. Remember, this is a big trigger warning that this show is so not for the faint of heart, and negative energy is so freaking not allowed. Especially after our last hang, not allowed.
Yeah. Yeah. More on that later.
Oh, definitely. I have a weird story to tell you too. I forgot when we on this morning. It's weird. I'll have to tell you.
Oh,
a little housekeeping. If you want a little more from us, we're on Patreon where you can listen early and ad-free. We also have a private Facebook group where you can hang out with more of our cool listeners like yourself. So go and join the fam. You're very welcome over there. If you like what you're hearing, please leave a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. We would appreciate it. And tell a friend, okay? Mention it to your therapist. Shout it at your cats at 2 a.m. when they are shrieking at you from the hallway because they're hungry. Whatever brings you joy, just spread the word. All of our links and ways to find us and reach us are in the show notes, so go ahead and check that out at your leisure. And that's it. We're going to get into this, and it's a dark one.
Yeah. I mean, there's no easing into it, I don't think.
No.
So
it's just...
Here we go. Yeah. Buckle up.
Yeah. Buckle up. It's dense. It's intense. It's going to put everybody on the offense. Wasn't going to rhyme, but you know what? Felt right sometimes. Yeah, today, if you read the show notes, you know it's another Hometown Macabre for you. And yeah, this week's topic, just really buckle up. And we're going to break it down as best as we can today. And we hope you enjoy it. But like I said, trigger warning, this is so, it's dark for violence, for unsuspecting crime, because this is, it's really rough. It's heartbreaking on so many levels today. And it's something that was brought into mainstream media at the time by an author. This was so not heard of back in the day. And this story is actually considered the very first concept of true crime as we know it today. So that's why we're covering it today. We are going to be talking about the Clutter Family Murders, made famous by a book called In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. My show notes are, it all started with a lie in prison and ended with a family brutally murdered. The Clutter family never saw it coming. Headlines spread across America, catching the attention of a very prominent writer. Join us as we talk about the story that made true crime what it is today. Let's get into it. This all took place in Holcomb, Kansas. So let's lay out a little bit about Holcomb. It's small. And this is why it shocked so many people. Holcomb is a super small town with just over 2,100 people today.
Okay.
And yeah,
that's relatable. It's very much like the town I grew up in. So, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And back then it was even smaller. So it's like, dang. It's located in Finney County, Kansas, and it's right next to the Arkansas River west of Garden City. It was founded in 1872 and originally called Sherlock.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm like, I would have kept the name Sherlock.
Yeah.
The community was built up slowly. It started with a sectioning house and then followed by a water tower. And originally it was actually designed to be a stopping point for trains. And the railways were going hardcore back then. And they really wanted it to start as a boom town for the training buildings and business, right? But they weren't really into it at the time. They're like, you got to have a little more here before we're willing to stop. So It took them a while, but it wasn't until the 1880s that the town actually resembled something of a community. So it did take them a little bit of time. On December 3rd of 1909, the town's name officially changed to Holcomb. By the time we get into what we're going to talk about today, it had only been Holcomb for 50 years, which is really weird. Their first bank was established in 1912, and it was robbed for the very first time 5 years later, and $1,500 was taken.
That's a lot of money back in those days.
It was. It really was. It was then robbed again in 1930 by none other than the Flegal Gang.
Oh, that sounds like an interesting...
Oh, yeah.
I don't know the Flegal Gang, but...
You don't?
No.
It's a cool true crime story, too. There's a lot of mystery and, like, conspiracy with it. That'd be kind of fun to cover someday.
Yeah.
They're interesting. For those of you who don't know, the Flegal Gang was a known group, a couple people, for murder and robbing banks. That was, like, their specialty. The murder was kind of like an accident, and then it just blew up for them. But definitely a topic worth its own story to cover later. Very weird. But that brings us all the way up to 1959, when the next shockwave would hit the town. And yeah, that's where our story starts today. Before we get into what happened, we really have to get to know the Clutter family and how on earth this all came to be, which it still doesn't make any sense, but ooh, it's tragic. So who were they? Well, let's start with Herbert Clutter. Herbert William Clutter was born on May 24th of 1911, and he was a super prominent figure in town. Really outstanding citizen. After he graduated from Kansas State University, he would become a chairman of the Kansas Conference of Farm Organization, a county extension agent, a member of the Federal Farm Credit Board, and a very active member in his church. Like, he was all over the place.
Damn, yeah.
Yeah.
He was doing things.
Oh, yeah. Like, there would, he did not sit down, I don't think.
He's one of those guys, yeah, probably, yeah. I could tell, like, you just have to be busy all the time, you know?
Right, exactly.
I know people right. like that.
Oh, yes, me too. And because of that, obviously, like, he was super well-respected, and to follow, his wife and his kids were the same way. Like, they were always doing something in the community, and Herbert had built himself up from the ground up, because he didn't come from much either. He started at River Valley Farm, and he made it his own, and he grew a bunch of wheat and fruit trees. And the fruit trees are more of a hobby, but then they ended up taking off. He was one of those people. So good for him. Like, mm-hmm. That's pretty awesome. Yeah. At one time, he had like 18 farmhands.
Oh, shit.
And, right? It's like, dang.
Big endeavor.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, that's crazy, especially for how long he had it. It's like, dang, I wish. But he had in his employment so many different types of people, coming from all ages just to work for him. And so many of them reported how fairly he treated them and how fairly he paid all of them. There wasn't any favoritism. He really loved them all like family. And a lot of people were very high praising of him. They really admired him. And maybe not Floyd Wells so much, but we'll talk about him later. He was one of the only farmhands who had anything in any negative way to say, but we'll talk about how he is wishy-washy later. Let's talk about Herbert's wife, Bonnie. So Bonnie Mae Fox Clutter was born on January 7th, 1914. Very active also in her community. Super well-known in the garden club in her area until she got married to Herbert. And then she still went to garden club, but she was starting to do other things. So both her and Herbert were very active people. She had four children with Herbert. And after having them, she had suffered from clinical depression and some physical ailments that came with childbirth. Now, in the book, they really play up on this. After some of the reports I saw, I think it was dramatized. I don't think it was as bad as how they were trying to portray her in the book, but it's still rough. Like, going through that is still really rough. So after she was done having her kids, she did slow down a little bit, but by a lot of accounts, she was still doing stuff for the community afterwards. So it wasn't like this was something where she was completely bedridden or anything.
Yeah.
But more to come on that. She did remain a very respected member of Holcomb, just like her husband. And then that's when it really started for their kids. So Nancy Clutter, she was born on January 2nd of 1943. She was also super active in town. She was known for helping younger kids, learning tasks in life like how to make food, how to clean, how to, you know, do a bunch of things for projects at school. She babysat all the time. a lot of parents would bring their kids to her for tutoring and stuff. Super smart, super nice girl. She loved baking and riding her horse called Babe.
Aw.
I was like, oh, great. That's so cute. She excelled in school and was a member of the 4-H club, often very busy. When her boyfriend had been interviewed after the incident, he had said that, quote, she didn't have a bad bone in her body. She was everyone's friend, end quote. Mm. Super sad.
Sad.
Yeah. There's some debate on what happened during the incident that we'll talk about with her, unfortunately. And then we'll go on to Kenyon Clutter. So Kenyon Neal Clutter was born on August 28th of 1944. Highly intelligent kid for his age. He was known for loving to rebuild and modify machines and create things for himself, along with some mini inventions that if he would have had the opportunity, he probably would have worked for probably NASA or something. Like, genius kid. He was very gifted, but by a lot of accounts, he was known as a loner and not necessarily really well liked in school because he didn't like sports. And if you come from a small town, you know that football is like life for a lot of, yeah.
Well, yeah. So, and with him being such a intelligent kid and having a focus on like mechanics and, you know, just that creative mindset, analytical mindset, like probably maybe didn't have the most social skills because your brain is just usually sometimes geared differently.
Exactly. Exactly. And in a small town, unfortunately, that makes you kind of stick out.
Yeah.
And not
sad.
It is sad. Super sad. And then we talk about these four members first for a reason, but we should also mention the other two sisters who were not in the house at the time of the incident, but they will come into play later. There's Beverly Clutter. She was born on October 11th of 1939. And at the time of the murders, she was engaged to Vier Edward English. And the tragedy took place only 2 weeks before their wedding. I can't even imagine.
No.
Yeah.
How could you?
Right.
Like, I don't even know how you would go on with that.
No. Oh, gosh, no. I don't. Oh, I would be ruined. They were ruined, definitely ruined, obviously. But yeah, we'll talk a little bit about Beverly and her macabre morsels at the end and what her life kind of ended up gearing towards after the incident. And good for her. I mean, it says a lot about her for sure. But then we have Ivana Clutter, and she was born in June 26th of 1936. And at the time of the murders, she was living in Florida with her husband and son. So she had already had a family and was well established by the time this happened. So the two older girls were very much on their own, building a life for themselves. But everybody else was still back in Holcomb. So Beverly and Ivana were not anywhere near the place at the time. They were still back in their respective states, building up their family, but they were soon to come visit because of the wedding and stuff like that. So this is just a harder hitting impact, but they did go on to have some pretty incredible lives and build up something, you know, the happiness that they could feel after the fact. Unsurprisingly, it really did take a hard toll on the both of them, but we'll talk about them again in the macabre morsels. Mr. and Mrs. Clutter had made such an impact on their town, and their kids had so much potential, already making waves in town. And their happy lives would be cut so short, all because of a lie told by a former farmhand that worked for Herbert. So this is where we're going to start talking about, in chronological order, what the fuck happened here. We need to start by talking about Floyd Wells. If you remember me saying that just a little bit earlier, I had mentioned his name for a reason. So he was the one that worked for Herbert Clutter as a farmhand, and he worked there for quite a while. In a later report, he would say that he liked Herb and he liked working for him. But Yeah. He would later become a thief after his employment on the farm. He was arrested on charges of stealing lawnmowers and small appliances to start a rental business.
Oh my God.
Uh-huh. Good on you, Floyd.
Great.
He was so, like, something was just not right, you know?
Clearly.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah. He will get us his, like, 15 minutes of fame later that we'll get into, but how it started, right? So he's stealing all this shit, got arrested. He ended up in the Kansas State Penitentiary in Lansing, Kansas. And then he started sharing a cell with a man named Richard Hickok. Dick Hickok. Who was he? He was born in 1931 in Kansas City. In high school, he was super popular, a talented athlete. And that all changed in 1950 when he had a very serious car accident. So going forward, you're going to hear some things that you're hoping might have been the reason why things happened the way they did mentally for these people. Okay. I'm not excusing it by any means, but you're hoping that this was something to do with it because this is so fucking stupid. After the car incident, he never fully recovered. He suffered from some pretty severe head trauma, and it left him disfigured. And he was never mentally or physically the same, and he did some pretty interesting things. He did want to go on to college, but his parents couldn't afford to send him, so he became a mechanic. And I think between what he suffered from and having that bitterness of not being able to move on, peaking in high school, I think it just sent him into a weird funk. He did get married later and had three kids. And then not long after that, he started cheating on his wife. He ended up divorcing his wife to marry his mistress. And that would also end in divorce not long after. So he's having some weird stuff going on about just emotional connections with people.
Yeah, it sounds like obviously anytime you have head trauma, depending on where the trauma is, like frontal lobe especially, he's going to be more impulsive and, you know, your empathy and all that gets dialed down sometimes. And yeah.
Oh, so yeah.
That it does kind of explain something.
Right. Right. Exactly. And of course, like, we're not trying to, like, disclaim any of this or, like, try to, you know, excuse it at all.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. Based on the things that I've seen about how his life changed afterwards, it's like I think he kind of lost most of his sense of right and wrong, like, just not good.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of trauma all the way around. Sadly, doesn't always, you know, not everybody's able to recover and bounce back from that and go back to living a normal life. So
right. Right. Especially in that time. I mean,
oh yeah,
medical stuff. Ooh. But yeah, so after the whole divorces happened, he kind of hit another life crisis. And then he kind of just, like, wound deeper into this weird state. He had started writing out fraudulent checks and he was trying to make a living off of doing that. So he was going into places stealing, trying to make himself, like, look like a reputable person, and then saying, oh, I'm so sorry, I don't have anything in my wallet, can I pay you with a check? And because of the impression he left on these people, they're like, of course. And I mean, back when checks were you know, you regular
with that.
Yeah. So often he was able to get away with that kind of thing until he was caught, but it did land him in prison. And then that's where he would be a cellmate with Fred Wells, but he also became very good friends with a guy named Perry Edward Smith. And then things really started happening because him and Perry together made a really dangerous cocktail. So who was Perry Edward Smith? Well, Smith was born in 1928 in Huntington, Nevada. His parents were rodeo performers, believe it or not.
That's wild.
All right. Odd background. He does have a really dark past. I will say that. It would seem that he learned a lot of his antics actually from his dad. And there's a lot of reports from his childhood that he had a super abusive household. His dad would abuse his mom and other siblings on the daily. And in 1935, his mom left his dad and took the kids with her to California. And it said that she was a crippling alcoholic, and she had actually passed away when Perry was 13. And this would be from suicide. We'll talk more about what else happened in his family because it's so rough.
Yeah, sounds like a cocktail for disaster. So.
Oh, definitely. And especially at that time of like, this was a time where you had to hide your feelings, and basically the whole grit and bear it phrase was very prominent. You didn't talk about anything, you know. He and his siblings were actually transferred to a couple different orphanages after that because his dad was unfit to take care of them. And allegedly, there was some really horrific treatments in those orphanages towards the kids as well.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah. Perry was actually known to be a bedwetter when he was a kid, and it was never like addressed. Obviously, it probably was part of the trauma, to be honest.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, that's a big symptom in children, is if they're having a traumatic childhood, like that is part of it. I mean, not to say that's every single reason why every child ever had a bedwetting problem, but a big one. And the facilitators at one of the orphanages would get so angry at him that in the mornings, she would like rip him out of bed and beat the shit out of him. But he was basically doing it every night. So he was basically getting these beatings every freaking morning. Yeah. Ugh. Just rough all around. His other siblings were treated in very similar fashions. When he was a teenager, he was reunited with his dad and he tried to make some sort of relationship with him. But that only resulted in awful choices because he just tried to be like his dad. And then it just went spiraling from there. He would end up in and out of a juvenile detention facility and joining a gang after he got out the last time. And that was a group that was super involved with petty crimes. And eventually he just established that lifestyle and never turned back. He did join the army in 1948, where he fought in the Korean War.
They let him in?
Yeah.
I don't even surprising. Know. How? Like, they right? don't do background checks, I guess. Yeah. Not back then.
No. Different time. Different times.
Yikes.
But, yeah, can you imagine? And you would think a lot of people just think, oh, yeah, like, joining the army is going to fix you. You know, you need to do this. It's going to fix you. I mean, sometimes it does, but sometimes it doesn't. Like, if you've
sometimes
got a traumatic
the
background.
Opposite.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. He absolutely did not recover from that, and it just got worse when he got back because... Okay, well, first, before I forget, when he was fighting the Korean War, he was in trouble all the time. Like, he was actually in the stockades, like the army stockades, because he got in trouble for picking fights and beating the shit out of Korean civilians and other soldiers.
Oh, no. Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, if you're already geared towards violence and... You know, and then you put someone in a wartime scenario where they have access to do things.
Yeah.
Unchecked sometimes. Yeah. Just did not help his case or anyone's case in this situation. It sounds like coming out of that, I can only imagine how much worse off he would be.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, it's so bad. It gets worse, too. So even though he did all this stuff, he was actually... honorably discharged from the army.
How?
Apparently he had suffered some sort of wound and like ended up saving another soldier was what one of the reports said, but it really didn't go into detail. And I really think that whoever gave that to him really had to try. And they're probably like, we just need to get him out of the army.
Yeah.
Because he had like records upon records of his violent tendencies in the army. So I have a feeling that was probably part of it. But when he was discharged, he ended up starting a life in Tacoma, where he started a mechanics spot with one of his other army buddies. And so he became a car painter. And during this time, he started trying to build a life for himself. He bought a motorcycle, but unfortunately, very similar to Richard, he had an accident. And that motorcycle incident almost killed him. He was hospitalized for 6 months. And despite surviving, he would not be able to live the same life. His legs were disfigured. He was still able to walk on them, but they were in such pain and they shifted a lot that he was constantly taking aspirin because it was the only thing that kind of cut the pain. But he was like taking them like candy.
Yeah, which we know is really bad for your liver.
Definitely. Definitely. This, of course, would lead him down another pathway of even more bad life decisions. And those things would put him in the Kansas State Penitentiary, where he would find Richard. And that's kind of where things start happening, right? Everybody knows everybody. And that brings us to 1959. At this time, Perry and Richard were like best buds. They had heard the story that Floyd Wells told them, and we'll get into that. But Perry was paroled in July of 1959. Richard would get out a month later. And the two of them were reacquainted, and they kept in touch while Richard was still in. They developed a plan to go to the Clutter family home that Floyd Wells had told Richard about. Okay, we know that's the plan, but what exactly did Floyd tell them? Why is this a thing? Okay, get this. Floyd had told Richard while they were hanging out in their cell one day that Herbert Clutter was a super wealthy man in Holcomb, Kansas, a very prominent, well-respected figure who made bank on his little farm, right? And what he had ended up telling Richard was that somewhere hidden in their amazing home was a safe with $10,000 in it. And by today's standards, that's over $75,000. So this obviously was something Richard was not going to let go or forget, even with a mention, like just a passing story of gossip in your cell, just trying to talk time away, right? This was something that never, ever left Richard's brain. This made such a lasting impression on him that he started communicating with Smith on how to get that money. So the robbery plan was born. In the wee hours of the morning on November 15th, 1959, Dick and Perry invaded the Clutter home. They made their way all the way to Holcomb by stealing a vehicle and picking up supplies to do so. They had done it. Four of the six family members were in the home in their beds at that time. They went through the entire house only to find that there was no safe. They were outraged. In their rage, they had conjured up the plan that, hey, this should have been a cinch. We should have had money and been able to get out of here. Nobody woke up initially when they went through the house the first time. Why didn't this work? So then they started becoming more clumsy. They didn't care who they woke up in the house at this point because they were super angry. And they deliberately went into Herbert's bedroom and woke him up by shining a flashlight in his face. And they said, "Where in the F is your safe?" basically. And poor Herbert was like, "What?" You know, he didn't know anything about this. And so Herbert, being the nice guy that he was, like, "Here, I'll give you my wallet. I'll give you what's in my wallet. I don't have any money in the house." Well, he pulled out his wallet and he had $42 in there. That was it. This made them even more angry. So they woke up the rest of the household. They again looked through the entire house and they realized that Mr. Clutter was telling the truth. There was no safe. There was no money. All hell broke loose then, and they ransacked the entire house and promised that there would be no witnesses. Listeners, this is another trigger warning for you that this is going to get really dark, and I'm going to start reading a couple of police reports because they say it a little better than I could describe it, and it's pretty graphic. So, buckle up. So, for the report that came from the police station at the Garden City office, their report reads the following. Quote, when officers arrived, Herb Clutter, 48, lay sprawled on a mattress in the basement, stabbed, his throat slashed, and a gunshot charged fired to his head. He wore pajamas. His hands were bound and his mouth was taped shut. On a couch in an adjoining room was 15-year-old Kenyon Neal Clutter, bound, gagged, and shot in the head. In separate upstairs bedrooms were the bodies of Mrs. Bonnie Mae Clutter, 45, and Nancy Mae Clutter, 16. Mrs. Clutter was bound and gagged, Nancy only bound. Each had been shot in the head. Garden City Police Department Chief Mitchell Geisler was the first on the scene, and officers arrived shortly after to the horrific scene. Accompanying him was Assistant Chief Rich Rolletter. Rolletter was an expert photographer and used his skills to photograph the crime scene. Although technology wasn't nearly the level it is today, it was through Rolletter's photographs that the discovery of a bloody footprint remaining from Smith, and this footprint was not visible to the naked eye. A photograph was also taken of a tire track left in the haste by the murders, end quote. This all happened in less than 2 hours from the time they broke in to the time they left.
2 hours doesn't seem like a long time, but it seems like a really long time.
Right.
You know what I mean? I can't imagine going through that for 2 hours.
No. And we don't know how long it was before they woke them all up. Even so, I can't imagine how that must have felt like a freaking eternity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I would guess that they handled Herbert first.
Some of the accounts, and this is where it gets kind of skewed, because despite Truman Capote writing in the beginning that all accounts were true in his book, he absolutely took theatrical liberties, and it has since kind of skewed what potentially could have happened. He wrote the book as if somebody had gone in and seen the whole scene take place. So there's a lot of weird things that are kind of assumed but not really known. What they think may have happened was after initially waking up Herbert Clutter, they woke everybody up individually after that and shoved them into the bathroom upstairs. And then they were taking out one family member at a time and bringing them back to their bedroom and then tying them up and then coming back and doing it again and like potentially interrogating them in the process. If this is true, the assumption is that they took Nancy first, then Bonnie, and then they took Kenyon first down to the basement, and then Herbert was last. But then they worked in the opposite order to eliminate them.
Finish the job, yeah.
Yeah. We will definitely talk about how it was skewed in reports and the courts as well, because they were never fully honest about what happened either. Oh, yeah, it gets more intense too. So, as we know, there wasn't that fictional $10,000 in cash, and that all of these lives were taken for a mere $42, a transistor radio, and a pair of binoculars. Yeah. They ended up just taking those things on their way out of the house because they're like, well, fuck this. We didn't get our money or anything.
Yeah. Let's go pawn this stuff.
Yep.
Yeah. It's awful.
It's so awful.
Listeners can't see me. I'm being very quiet because I'm just Well, one, I'm in shock and I'm just sitting here like shaking my head.
Yeah.
I don't really have words.
No. It's so gross. It's like, I can't fucking believe. And it gets even more interesting when you hear this, some of the stuff that's going to be said, you just want to slap somebody. It's so fucking ridiculous. So the report that I'm going to tell you now. Yeah. So I'll read it verbatim because I'm just like, this case really just like pisses me off. As so many of them do, but like, this all because of a fucking lie. So the report goes on to the list that I was reading previously. It had gone on. So I'm going to read a little bit of that again about the route, because I can talk today. Route. It talks about the route that Smith and Hickok took after they left, which you're like, what the fuck? You know.
One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today. And get your old self back naturally.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
So the report continues, quote, they fled to the Kansas City area where Hickok wrote a series of hot checks. After overstaying their welcome, they decided to flee to Mexico, where they lived for a short period of time. There, they pawned the binoculars and eventually hitchhiked their way through California en route to Omaha, Nebraska. After a short stay in Omaha, they made their way to Iowa, where they stole a car and returned to Kansas City. From Kansas City, they eventually traveled to Florida and then made their way to Nevada. Like, they were just, like, all over the place. And I get, like, oh, I don't want to stay in a place too long. But one, they already fucked that up because they overstayed somewhere. And then they're just, like, all over. Just, it's clear that there's something not going on right with them. Like, it's just, come on. By the afternoon of November 15th, word had spread about an incident that had gone down at the Clutter family home throughout Finney County, because they were prominent in Holcomb, but their outreach spread past the town. And people were in shock because they're like, who could have done this, especially to them? Within a week, headlines had spread across America, shocking the nation because no one had ever expected such a horrific crime to take place in such a small farming town to a family who was active in their community. This was something that you heard about in novels, big cities, and not full families. Like, this was something that had never been really fully focused on before. And Floyd Wells hears about the murders on the radio in prison and then decides that he's going to get an interview with some investigators about it. So he claims that he was shocked to hear about the news on the radio.
Oh, that fucker.
Huh? It's like, really? Even though you were the one that fucking lied about it and told this in jail?
I really hope that he is implicated in some way. I know that's wishful thinking, but I hope that somehow he has some responsibility for what happened.
We will definitely get into that. I don't think it's going to be what you want it to be because it wasn't what I wanted it to be. But
yeah,
let's just say karma is real.
Okay, good. That makes me happy. I'm good with that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, when you hear about what he did to get the truth out about this, oh. So, after some attempts, they were able to bribe Wells after he did this on purpose. He specifically asked to talk to an investigator, and he just mentioned something about the Clutter family murders. Like, I should have just never said anything, you know? Just a real vague statement. And then they're like, what did you say? So he totally played them. And they were so desperate for information because they just could not figure out who did it. They bribed Wells for $1,000 and early parole.
Oh, shit. I mean, that's big. Yeah.
Right. And that's how desperate they were because they had nothing. And people were panicking all over the area. And they were getting some pretty big heat from their bosses because they're like, you need to arrest somebody soon because people are all out panicking right now about this and nobody's leaving their homes. Like, this is rough. And they did. This is what they offered him. So after that, Floyd ratted out the whole thing about his old cellmate, his friend Perry, and their cohorted plan to just go and have a time, right? But he claims that he never heard their plan, that it was just kind of a, oh, I think I might have a job to do in Kansas when I'm out of jail kind of deal. It's like, you knew what you were doing. You knew when he was going to be paroled and you knew what kind of guy he was. And you didn't think, oh, I should just go off about my old employer. Yeah, you're going to. I can't wait to hear your comments about this. The following statement is made by Floyd Wells to Agent Wayne Owens of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, KBI, on December 10th of 1959, and it's taken from an original unpublished case note. Quote, this is what Floyd said. I spent considerable time with him, talking about Herb Clutter, in his office, where he had a desk and I believed a safe. This was the old house where the Clutters lived in 1949, which was also located on the Clutter family farm. It's the same house. This was just about the time their new house was completed. I strictly remember Mr. Clutter paying a large lumber bill, and I thought he paid it in cash with money from the safe. The reason I remember is because Mr. Clutter made the remark to me that evening when we left his den that he'd pay out more than $10,000 that day. After entering Kansas State, meaning the penitentiary, I celled with Dick Hickok. Hickok said he liked Western Kansas and maybe would try to get a job from the Clutters when he got out. I described the location of the house. I suspected I talked too much about the money Mr. Clutter had, but Hickok talked a lot about Perry Smith. So after that, they got out of the joint. They could pull some jobs to get enough money for a down payment on a boat. They would run a charter service for deep sea fishermen and eventually make contacts and use the boat to bring in some narcotics. And I didn't believe Hickok, but he kept talking about it. And I tried to talk him out of it and said he would get caught, but he had a plan. And after the robbery, would kill everyone there had ever been so there would be no witnesses, end quote. So clearly Floyd Wells is also a little fucked in the head.
Well, yeah, we know that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I still don't really have words.
No. It's awful. But here's where we start to see some things turn. Where we're like, okay, finally, can we just get them out of the picture?
Let's get to the meat and potatoes, please.
Yeah. So on December 30th of 1959 at 5:25 p.m. in Las Vegas, there were a couple parole officers that were just making their rounds. They had a list of all of the mugshots throughout the U.S. to say, hey, like, be on the lookout for these people. And I mean, that makes sense. It's Las Vegas, right?
Yeah.
There, these two officers recognized these mugshots of these two gentlemen, and they were apprehended because they were thinking this could potentially be Dick and Perry. In their possession was a stolen car and the pair of boots that would seal their fate for the crime scene.
Oh, good.
Yep. Initially, the parolemen were right to suspect them because they brought them into a fixed up confession area in Vegas. I mean, they were not technically in the jurisdiction for the crime, obviously, being in Nevada, but it worked out. They made it happen. They confessed everything in Nevada, even before they got to Kansas. Hickok claimed that Smith did all of the killing, and Smith said that Hickok killed all the women, but then later would make a full confession that he was fully responsible. No one truly knows who actually did what because they were so wishy-washy about it. It is believed that Hickok was more violent than Perry based on other records, but we don't know that for sure.
I just say throw the book at both of them equally.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can't, you know, there's no way to really know. They're both going to lie. Just fucking slam the book on both of them.
Yep.
The same shit.
Agreed.
Charge them both for everything.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I mean, I guess if you're in the heat of the moment like that and you're like, you need to confess, you're going to say some shit, but it's like, I just think it's so interesting when you hear about some of these people that will throw the other person under the bus.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, they're criminals, so
yeah.
There's no loyalty there.
No, but it's just like, really? Like, do you hear what you're saying? Like, so here's a little tidbit about why Smith had originally said, oh, I didn't kill the women, and then like change his mind. So in an intimate interview that he had did, he had confessed that he knew Richard's parents and they were not doing very well health-wise. And so Smith had said that he didn't want Richard's parents to go to their graves thinking that their son was a killer, so he took all the blame. Which I'm like, interesting how you would then turn your empathies around, but also it's like too fucking late.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I feel bad for Richard's parents. I really do. But like, maybe Richard shouldn't have been a dick.
Yeah.
After they had made this confession, they were taken back to Finney County, Kansas, where they stood trial. Both of them refused to testify. And on March 29th of 1960, they were both found guilty very quickly and given the death penalty. They waited on death row for 5 years. And in that time, they got to know an author by the name of Truman Capote. And this is how Truman gets involved with all of this. And some believe that the reason why they were on death row for so long is because Truman kept trying to appeal for them. We'll talk about that. It just got really weird with them. We'll get into it. It's very weird. So the writer arrives. Truman Streckfus Persons was born on September 30th, 1924 in New Orleans, Louisiana, to a salesman and a beauty queen. What a way to start your life. What a story.
Right?
His parents were divorced when he was 4 years old, and then he went to live with his aunt in Alabama. By 11, Truman was showing true potential in his writing skills, and in 1933, he moved to New York to live with his mother and stepdad, who adopted him and changed his name to Truman Garcia Capote, as we know him today. With this name, he would become the American author, playwright, actor, and screenwriter that he would become super famous for. His two defining works were Breakfast at Tiffany's and In Cold Blood. At the end of November of 1959, Capote was reading the New York Times when he saw the story of the Clutter family. He took immediate interest in the case. It was something that he had never seen before and never could imagine. So much that happened shortly after that he decided that he was going to travel to Holcomb to get all of this written down. How much drama could happen in a small town? Well, he was about to find out, and he was probably going to add to the drama. He was accompanied by his friends, Sandy Campbell, who was a fact checker for the New York Times, and the one and only Harper Lee, who he was like best friends with.
Wow.
Yeah. He wanted to research the case and he wasn't going to leave until he knew the bottom of it. So he interviewed townsfolks, investigators, and even Dick and Perry. He was given access to them on death row. And originally, his research was supposed to be a mini-series that he was hired to do and post for the New York Times, which is why Sarah was there. But he soon realized that after the convicted criminals had completely ratted each other and that he had a bunch of pages of notes that this was so not going to be a mini-series, this had to be a novel, and he was not going to give up this information. This account is considered by many the very first true crime case that we know as the concept of true crime today, and that is all based on Capote's approach to the incident and how he wrote it. Before that, obviously, we've seen some really horrible cases throughout the world, but he was the very first to turn it into this. So how it ends, it's really crazy, and we're going to find out more about Capote and his connections, because he grew really attached to Perry Smith in jail. He could give like two shits about Dick Hickok, but for some reason, him and Truman had a weird connection in jail. Yeah, we'll get into it. It's a very weird series of events. So how it ended, the Clutter family had a shared funeral, and they were buried in Valley View Cemetery in Garden City, Kansas. Floyd Wells was killed in a prison break in Mississippi sometime after he snitched on Hickok and Smith before he got his parole. Nobody truly knows how he died, but it's assumed that people ganged up on him and did the job. Karma, yeah. I guess.
Karma.
Yeah. Dick and Perry's last meal, a nod to, yeah.
Yeah, to our Patreon morsels episode on death row last meals, if you haven't listened to that.
Yeah, very interesting. Check that out. Yes, please do. Very interesting. And their meal was interesting. They shared the same meal. So they ordered spiced shrimp, French fries, garlic bread, ice cream, and strawberries with whipped cream.
And they got what they asked for?
Yeah.
According to...
Yeah. Yep. And I feel like maybe Truman may have had some play in that too.
Oh, well, yeah, could be.
We'll talk a little bit more about that. Perry Smith and Richard Hickok were executed by hanging on April 14th, 1965.
That's interesting to me too, because I don't know how late in the timeline for executions when the last hanging happened.
I want to say, and I should have looked it up for this episode, but it wasn't long after that, I feel like.
It just feels so late in the timeline to be hanging people still.
I don't know.
Yeah. What an awful way to go.
There's an actual, I put it in the morsel, but Truman Capote had an interview with Johnny Carson about this. It's interesting. I can't wait to tell you about it, but they were talking very much about the death penalty and how Truman had witnessed it because he was there for this.
Oh, shit. Okay.
Yeah. And this had to have been really close to one of the last that they did, but I need to look into when the last one was because it had to have been so shortly after this. Because, 1965.
That's late to be doing hangings, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you think about in Paris, Christopher Lee. Yeah.
He witnessed it. That's insane.
I know. It was the last one, and that was in, like, was that in the 60s or 70s?
It had to be.
Yeah.
It had to be.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's so crazy. It's, you're not that far removed from that shit when you think about it. You're like, oh, damn.
Yeah, I have been playing around with the idea. This is a side tangent. We can cut it or whatever. Keep it for season three, the letter E. At one point, we talked about the electric chair and the history of that. But it's almost like maybe we should just cover executions.
Executions.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we
and
should.
Just, it's so macabre and dark and morbid. And there's so many things that happen throughout history, different eras. It could be really interesting to see how, like, things have evolved. And yeah,
I agree. I think we should.
So put a pin in that for later, people. Maybe I'll cover executions.
Yeah. Oh, you should. That episode would be long.
Yeah.
But it'd be good.
And yeah, we could do like morsel style a little bit, but dig into some of the deeper content on some things. So
yeah,
we'll see what that looks like.
Definitely. Because I feel like some of the styles defined cultures throughout time, which is weird to say, but I think it really did. And look at the French Revolution. It was basically the whole culture was built around the guillotine. Yeah.
Season three is for executions.
You heard it here first.
Yeah. You got the inside scoop.
So based on reports that were pulled from the police department, Hickok's last words were, "You're sending me to a better place," end quote. Oh, yeah. I have some thoughts about that.
I have some thoughts on that, too.
And apparently, like, he shook people's hands and was, he just, like, it was, like, so matter of fact.
I just got the ick. I just got the ick.
Yeah, exactly. He's so gross. And I didn't even cover other shit that he did. Just no thank you. When it was Smith's turn, they were executed just like 20 minutes apart from each other, 20 to 30 minutes. Hickok did go first, but when it was Smith's turn, his last words were allegedly, quote, "I think it is all hell of a thing that a life has to be taken in this manner. I say this especially because there's a great deal I could have offered society. I certainly think capital punishment is legally and morally wrong. Any apology for what I have done would be meaningless at this time. I don't have any animosities towards anyone involved in this matter. I think that is all."
Thanks, bud. Thanks for your statement. No one gives a shit what you think about what capital punishment is or is not morally right. You fucking murdered a family. So
exactly.
Sorry, dude.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that all of your opinions are fucking moot after the shit that you pulled, because I think legally, morally, what you did was fucked. So get fucked.
Yeah.
When you hear last statements sometimes, or like court statements from some of the people that do this kind of shit, I just want to just punch them.
It's so enraging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine being a family member or friend of the victim and having to be in court and hearing that come out of the person's mouth.
Yeah.
I would probably end up in jail because I would come over the fucking thing and like probably kill them myself. We'll talk a little bit more later about the hanging. Not too much, but we need to talk about the Clutter family home. What happened to it? It was sold in an auction after Beverly and Ivana decided that they couldn't emotionally handle taking care of the place. I don't blame them. I couldn't do it. And one of the saddest things is, yes, okay, it was true-blown auction style. And so somebody helped them, obviously. They just stepped away and let it happen. They took what they wanted, but they just didn't want to deal with it. And so one of the more personal things that kind of hit me really hard was Nancy's horse Babe was sold at this auction for $75. And by so many people that were interviewed, like Nancy's friends and stuff, they were like, that horse was her life. And the fact that it sold for $75, and they were just like, we just hope that Babe has a good life and that they take care of Babe, because, and that's just like, that's, it's such a random fact, but it's like, it just hits so hard at the same time. It's just like, that was a 16-year-old girl's horse. Yeah. So we're going to get into some macabre morsels now, and it's going to get a little more gritty, and we're going to find out some more details about what was happening in this timeline that we just talked about, because it's interesting and just overall really fucked up. So Let's talk about Perry Smith's family a little bit. We had mentioned that things were messed up, right? Well, his father and all of his siblings, except one sister, ended up committing suicide.
Shit.
Yeah. His father was an older man at the time that he committed the act. Records vary. Some say he was in his knees, others say late 80s. Either way, he was an older gentleman when it happened. His two siblings, when they had done it, they were young adults when they decided to do that. The other sister that was left had cut off all communication with him and the remaining part of the family before that happened. So she just didn't want anything to do with any of it. So she may or may not have known all that was going on at this time. Truman Capote bought their original headstones for Dick and Perry, but they were later stolen. It took Truman 6 years to finish In Cold Blood. The book actually destroyed his career. And many argue also him. The Clutter home still stands today, but do not go there. Listeners, this is your public service announcement for the episode. It is still a regular residence, and the owners are not welcome of trespassers. They do have dogs and stuff on property, so please do not decide that this is where you want to go adventure, because it is still a residence. So please do not disturb the family that lives there.
Respect.
In November of 1966, Capote hosted a masked ball at the New York Plaza Hotel to celebrate the book and his publisher, Catherine Graham. It became the social event of the year and brought him into the spotlight of New York high society, where he hit the peak of his career, but then it plummeted him at the same time. Many would claim later that Capote's novel on the crime wasn't fully true. As he stated in the beginning of his book, he wrote that it was true facts through, and it was listed as a true crime nonfiction novel. I believe that the statement in the beginning of the book should have read based on the
true
crime.
Events. Yeah.
Because when you read the book, it has a very flowery language, something that you would expect from Capote, very his fashion, but there is no way that anybody would ever be able to know as much detail as is in the book. There's some scenes that he actually, I believe, made even worse because of how he played them out. And I don't want to get into details, but if you haven't read In Cold Blood, I do highly recommend the book. It is very well done, but you will, after hearing this story today, I think you're going to see that he really did skew the book. He made a sympathy case for the criminal, specifically Perry Smith, who he developed a very close friendship with when he did the interview. So we'll talk about that. But there's a lot of dialogue that we can't ever confirm was ever said. Some things that we can't confirm ever happened during the incident. So a lot of people loved the book. A lot of locals hated the book. Many grew very distasteful of some of the details that he had written because there is no way to state them as fact. He also became really close in that 5-year period that he talked with Perry Smith to Perry Smith while interviewing him on death row. In a particular reason, he, in my case, after doing some more research on their dialogue and like what happened, I really think that Perry played him like a fiddle to get sympathy to try to get out of death row.
As most manipulators and criminals do.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. And I think that's probably why the book was written the way it was. I don't know. Capote would have been better off stating that this was just like a dramatization because he was relying on the accounts of the killers. And he was interviewing investigators, but it's so clear that he took this sympathetic view. It was stated that the very first time Capote met Perry, Perry was having issues with his legs. Like we said, he was like popping aspirin like candy. He couldn't have that on death row. And this is like a side tangent, but I think this is how it all set them up for this. Instead of greeting him with hello, Perry asked Capote for a favor. And when you do that in jail, that means something completely different. And he was trying to play a psychological game because when you greet somebody and meet somebody for the very first time, psychologically, if somebody asks for a favor first, your brain wants to connect with them on a more personal level.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
Yeah. And that's exactly what he did. Truman came up to him and he's, Perry Smith? And he's, can I ask a favor? Do you have any aspirin? My legs are just really hurting me right now. And at the time, Truman didn't have any. But it's clear that this made an impression on him, because in the so many times that he came back to visit and hang out with Perry, the very next time that he came to visit him, he gave him a bunch of freaking aspirin and brought him cigarettes. Yeah. Yeah. This just goes to show, right? We know the skewed story, right? And more on the morsels now, getting off my side story tangent to just give you more of a background on how I think that all came down. A crazy fact, Capote had 8,000 notes on this story. Handwritten 8,000 notes.
Yeah, that's a lot.
The book became an overnight success, especially in Kansas, believe it or not. Even though the locals found it super distasteful, it was booming in Kansas. In an interview we had talked about really shortly before this, I talked about Johnny Carson. With an interview that he did with Mr. Carson after the novel was published, Carson had mentioned talking about what was it like to be a witness at an execution. He talked about the very controversial topic of the death penalty at that time, because it was a hot topic at that time already. And Capote just... he's answered so matter-of-factly, because Johnny Carson said, you know, I think people are so on the fence about, you know, the death penalty that if people saw this in person, they may change their mind. They may not favor it as much if they had to see it in person. And Capote, very like deadpanned, I watched this interview, very deadpan for him. He completely disagreed with him. And he said that, I think that if public executions were to take place in broad daylight, in public, millions of people would show up to watch the execution. Which, I could see his opinion. Look at the French Revolution.
Yeah, I was to say, if history has taught us anything, that
yeah,
the public is interested in seeing the macabre. As we know, people, it was a spectacle. They were selling goods and food, yeah, and
dolls, fashion
stuff. Yeah,
yeah.
People are macabre. People, yep, are always gonna people and be morbid, uh-huh, and have a curiosity about those things.
Yep. So true. So true. Yeah. If you want to watch an interview, just another side note, it is on YouTube. If you type in Truman Capote and Johnny Carson, it's like a 6-minute clip. And that interview took place in, I think it was like 1960. It was like the late 60s. It's a very interesting timepiece for sure. So I highly recommend that. In the book Cold Blood, we had learned a lot about this incident. There were some maybe fake personal connections that the reader would make to the family, to the criminals, based on how Truman Capote wrote it. And one of the last morsels I have for you today is this book basically killed Truman Capote, maybe literally and physically. In the years that followed, his publishing was not the same. He never fully finished another book. The author, after this particular piece, had turned to drugs and alcohol, and he began fighting with his friends. He lost all of his connections, basically. He cut everybody out. And he never finished another work. He never was interested in publishing anything else, even a snippet piece. Capote had died at the age of 59 to an overdose. And no one truly knows whether this was by accident or by suicide. When you see him in that interview with Johnny Carson, you can tell that he was shook up by being present at that death sentence. And the fact that he had such a close connection with Perry, you can tell it really took a lot out of him, and he became a completely different person after that. He was actually quoted once saying that, quote, no one will ever know what in cold blood took out of me. I think in a way it did kill me. End quote.
That's a lot to take on. And he spent 6 years writing that. That's a lot of darkness and putting you in a place where, you know, that's traumatizing in so many ways. I can't really see how he would be the same after taking on a project like that.
And to be there for all of it.
And oh, yeah.
Shortly after it. Yeah, I can't imagine. And Capote was known for being eccentric. He was nerdy posh in his time. And this was something so different for him that, yeah. Listeners, if you have not read this book, I do recommend it. Just know that it's more of a flowery language and you're not probably going to get all of the true facts. Some things have come forth since then to state, hey, in this particular chapter, how he describes this was actually not true at all. But you definitely get the feel for what happened. And it is the very first concept of a true crime piece that we know today. And without that book, I don't think that you would be seeing documentaries, podcasts, movies, and shows as you do now. I think it would look a little different.
Yeah.
That was a tough one. Very dense one.
My tummy is a little questionable.
Yeah. It took me a while to get through this one. It made me a little nauseous and gave me a headache for sure. Yeah. That's it. It's a lot, but that's it.
Yeah.
Listeners, what do you think? Even though this is the very first concept, reach out to us. Tell us what's your favorite. We want to know what stories that really got you into true crime. What was it that really made you interested? What was it? What piece was it? Everybody's got one thing that kind of drew them in.
Definitely. Talked about this with the ladies from Live Laugh Lore about like our obsessive piece.
Yeah.
What was yours? I don't remember you saying what yours was, or I had too many drinks and I just...
No.
Yeah.
I never said it because I couldn't make up my mind. I don't think for me it was true crime. I actually think it was technically dark history. And it was...
Well, it's good that we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah.
But true crime, of course, falls under that too, but yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it would be the French Revolution.
That's right. Well, you did say that.
Oh, I did? Oh, okay. Hey.
Yeah, you did.
I forgot.
I remember now.
Yeah. But yeah, that was murder. That was true crime.
It was a lot. It was a lot of murder.
It was. Oh.
Yeah. And we're obviously mine for listeners who are going to hear that piece in the future. You'll get to hear mine.
Yeah.
And I'm actually covering mine in a special mini series at some point.
So excited.
Yeah. Good time.
Should we tell them now?
No.
Okay. Okay.
No. Just tease. It's fine.
Yeah. I can't wait to make the announcement for...
I know. We have a lot of announcements, actually, that will be coming up around season 3. So
it's going
to be exciting. Speaking of announcements, I do want to give a shout out to our newest Patreon members, our new freaky friends, Cameron and Bree. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your support over there. We hope you enjoy the shenanigans and you're about to hear another episode of Worst Ways to Die. Renaissance edition.
I'm so excited.
We really hope you enjoy that. But yeah, to all of our listeners on the main platform, our amazing supporters on the Patreon group, you have no idea.
No.
For all the people who leave our 5-star reviews, it means the world to us. It helps us to keep doing what we're doing, get the show out there in front of other people. And I'm just going to say it again, but for our Patreon supporters, it really helps us with the day-to-day of running this show.
Yeah.
So we really appreciate you sticking around for that. And we're just excited to continue to bring you bonus content and all the fun stuff that we have coming in the future. So
absolutely.
You freaking rock. We freaking love you.
Yeah. Hallie spoke it in amazing ways because... honestly, we're speechless and she's right. We can't do this without you. And we're so grateful. thank you very much for coming to hang with us today and every day.
Yeah.
We do love you guys so much.
Yeah. And we love doing this. So
yeah.
When you keep showing up consistently, it fills our dark hearts.
It does. It does. As we grow, we're going to be able to do those like pipe dream ideas that we keep putting on the Facebook group. So many people want a macabre field trip.
And that'd be badass.
It'd be so awesome. And just know we want that. We really do. And we try really hard to make this stuff come out as fast as we can for you guys. And unfortunately, it is one of those things. Where we have to grow first in order to make some of this happen. You guys are doing that. Incredible. Incredible. You make our freaking day every fucking day. So thank you.
Yeah.
We needed a little mush at the end of that episode. My gosh.
Yep.
But.
And then.
Before.
You want to take us out here?
Yeah.
Could see it burning in your eyes. I know. Something.
I know. Like before it gets more mush, because I will mush more mush. We just want to say yes. We love you. And as always, have fun. Be safe. Be kind. Okay. And we'll shock you later.
Yeah. Bye. If I betray him, the reward will be me. Are you from his kingdom? I am the knight. The bridge. Shrek the time to sleep. Shrek the name of the day. In this war, it ain't that.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.